Yes. The Gentlemen of Japan, Gilbert and Sullivan, of course. You can spot their music instantly, can't you? And that's music from the Mikado, a very English version of Japanese culture. Well, the Japanese men on whom the Mikado is based appear in a new novel. It's called The Watchmaker of Filigree Street. For Books and Arts, debut novelist Natasha Pulley is speaking from Cambridge to Kate Evans.
So we're in London in 1884. The book actually begins in 1883, and it begins in a telegraphy office in Whitehall, which is the centre of government at the time. And what's going on is that this is the beginning of the very serious bombings that started to happen in London at the beginning of the 1880s. It was terrorism by an Irish group called Clan na Gael, and they are, I think, the grandfathers of the modern day IRA. They were fighting for home rule, and one of the reasons that they were so militant is that nobody in the British Parliament was listening to them. And one of the things they did was they bombed significant parts of London. They threw a bomb in through the windows of an office in Whitehall. They arranged to have a bomb go off in Parliament, and they also blew up Great Scotland Yard. And the destruction of Great Scotland Yard is one of the first things that happens in the book.
One of the interesting things about this novel, The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, is that it both feels historical and not. I can get all of those references, but there is a touch of magic, or it feels as though there's a touch of magic. How did you intend this novel to work? I mean, did you imagine it as historical fiction or as something else?
I would say that it's 90% historical fiction. In fact, it's 90% historical fact. The 10% that is fantasy revolves around the main character, Kei Tamori, who can remember the future. Anything that he affects, anything that he touches, is, of course, fiction. He can kind of bottle weather control. He has a clockwork octopus that seems nearly alive, this kind of thing. The way that I arrived at it was to look into Victorian theories of physics and write as if they were correct and true. At the time, one of the prevailing theories of physics was the theory of the luminiferous ether, which means the light-bearing ether. They believed that there was a substance that had to transport light particles in the same way that air transports sound. And they thought that without this substance, there couldn't be light anywhere. But because there is light everywhere, they also believed that this substance was everywhere. And the reason that this is important for things like fantasy is that because it permeates everything, it also permeates the human brain, which in theory would give a medium for human thoughts and electrical impulses to move outside the cranium. So this is the theory behind all the mediums and the incredible stage kind of magic performances that they had. It wasn't just this fad that happened out of nowhere. It was based on real science, and I think a lot of people believed it. People like Arthur Conan Doyle believed it because it did seem like true science at the time.
Now, I can see how those theories of physics do become embodied in some of your characters, but I'd just like to go back to the Home Office and the telegraphy office and ask you to introduce us to Thaniel Stapleton. What sort of man is he? How would you describe him?
He's a young man. He's supposed to be about 23 or 24, but he always seems older than he is because he's had quite a difficult life. His mother died giving birth to him, and he was brought up by his father and his sister. He has a very good relationship with his sister, but she married a soldier and went to live in Edinburgh, so she's very far away. When his sister was widowed, she had to live on an army pension, which wasn't very much, and so he has to get a real job. And this is a problem for him, because he used to be a pianist. He was a concert pianist, but he wasn't earning enough, and never would earn enough. And so he started work as a clerk, and he learned telegraphy. So he spends all day tapping away at Morse code. He moves from a factory in Lincolnshire to the Home Office, which is a great opportunity for him. But actually, it's this incredibly grey, dull job, and he hates it. And
but he's good at it, isn't he?
He's very good at it. And the rhythms of the Morse code and the telegraph machine sometimes echo the rhythms of the music that he used to play, and he's got an incredible ear for it. but he's miserable.
And then he finds a watch. A watch appears. What's so special about this watch?
So, Daniel comes home one day, and he lives in this miserable apartment in Pimlico next to a prison. And he finds that his flat has been burgled. Someone's done all the washing up, and he finds a watch that's been left in a perfect velvet box on his bed. And the watch has a label on it. It says, "To Mr. Steepleton," which is his surname. So he knows it's definitely for him. When he takes it out, it's this kind of wonderful rose gold colour. And he is a synesthesiac, so he sees sound and hears colours. And the rose gold of the watch is the colour of a human voice, so it's special to begin with. But the watch is strange because at first he can't open it, even though it seems perfect. And a few months later, on the morning that the Scotland Yard bomb goes off, it finally opens.
And so this is where we circle back to the explosions and the rise in nationalist and terrorist forces that you talked about. And it's the both the Irish and Japanese nationalist uprisings that are sort of figuring along in the background of your novel. Why were you interested in both of those?
I was interested in the Irish stuff because they were the ones behind the bombings. So this is really significant with regard to life in London at the time. You couldn't live in London in 1884 and not know about these bombings. They were huge. I mean, they destroyed Scotland Yard completely. They bombed Parliament. The reason that I'm interested in Japan, I always have been interested in Japan, but the significant fact about it in the novel is that the watchmaker, Keita Mori, is a Japanese immigrant, and he lives about 200 yards away from a Japanese show village that was part of the Great Exhibition on the corner of Hyde Park. This was a real thing. It was built in a place called Humphreys Hall, and it cost a few pence to go in. It was staffed with about 100 real Japanese artisans and their families. So these people are in London at the time. And once they started looking into them and the political situation in Japan at the time, it started really to mirror a lot of Irish nationalism. There was a huge problem with the clash between modernisation and traditional values in Japan at the time. And it led to quite extreme violence in some cases.
Thaniel goes to the workshop of the watchmaker. He tracks down this mysterious watch. What happens when he finally gets to that workshop?
When he finally reaches the workshop, it's pouring with rain outside and he's been hurt because he's been slightly caught in the very edge of the bomb blast and he's nervous. He thinks that the watchmaker must have something to do with the bomb. And when he comes in, he arrives in this marvellous workshop which is full of very strange clockwork. There's an orrery that floats on magnets. There's a huge golden locust clock and there are tiny clockwork birds that are flying everywhere and perching on the microscopes. And when somebody finally comes in, it's this tiny Asian man with dyed blonde hair, and he comes in with two cups of tea as though he's been expecting somebody. And when he speaks, he has a completely incongruous Lincolnshire accent, and Daniel is completely thrown. He has no idea what to make of this.
And this is where the Victorian world of 1880s London starts to come loose from its hinges almost as the fantastical elements enter into it. But of course you're keeping it in Victorian London because the automata, these magical things, they're all made from clockwork.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I think it's quite important with fantasy like this to keep it really well grounded, to keep a certain set of rules going all throughout. I didn't want it to be written so that anything could happen. It had to all be within the bounds of what was technically more or less possible in the period.
But it was still astonishing to Thaniel.
Yeah, completely astonishing to Thaniel. A lot of the clockwork Mori makes is completely impossible. He has a clockwork octopus called Katsu, which means Victor, who seems nearly alive and kind of octopuses about and makes very strange choices and steals socks and things. So he's kind of a comedy character and a sort of pet because Mori doesn't think that he would be able to keep anything living alive for very long.
The other thing that may or may not have been possible in Victorian London, I guess, was the friendship that developed. Thaniel and Maury like each other. Tell us about their relationship.
Thaniel is younger and immensely lonely and miserable. Maury starts to look after him really from day one. He sits him down, cleans him up, gives him a room for the night. Maury himself is older, he's nearly 40, and he's really from the last generation of real samurai. He's grown up in an incredible castle in Japan. It was real and it was destroyed in the 1870s. It's called Hagi Castle, it's right in the south. And he comes from a very big and very powerful clan who were on the right side of the civil war in Japan, in that they fought for the emperor, but they were still very conservative people. And he has been brought up very strictly, very carefully, in a very military way, even though he's really born on the wrong side of the sheets. He's the bastard son of his mother. So they're two very, very different people, but they go together very well because they each do something that the other can't do by themselves. Maury is looking after Thaniel, and Thaniel brings a sort of openness to Maury that he's been missing before. Their friendship is very close, but I think these things, of course, existed in Victorian London. It was just unspoken, and you don't see it written about so much in books that are not by Oscar Wilde. So it's difficult to say whether they would have been caught or whether it's completely viable. In fact, I don't think that even if they had been caught, they would have been prosecuted for it very quickly. Firstly, it was very hard to prove homosexuality. And secondly, it was very rarely prosecuted before Wilde's trial. There was a feeling among English judges that it didn't happen here. It was a kind of continental unfortunate condition.
And add Orientalism into the mix and everybody's head spins off.
Yeah, exactly. So I felt fairly safe saying that this was the relationship because they keep it so quiet. And although Grace sees them, she's from a kind of boarding school culture. She's been to Oxford. All her friends at Oxford are quite camp. She doesn't see it as a monstrosity. She sees it as a huge disadvantage for her that lands suddenly on her plate.
Now, we haven't explained who Grace is. And
that's
she ties together both some of the other big cultural shifts that are happening in the period, which is the changing world of women, but also science and physics. So tell us about Grace. Who's she?
Grace is a young student at Oxford University. And I think as soon as I say that, it sounds made up. But in fact, there were 9 female students at Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford in 1884. She's studying physics, and she's studying this theory of the luminiferous ether. What she's trying to do is prove it. She's trying to prove that it exists, and this was one of the great scientific endeavours of the late 19th century, trying to prove the luminiferous ether. When we meet her, she's setting up an experiment to prove it. And this means a huge amount to her, because if she can do it and pull it off, she will manage to live an academic life funded by the university. If she doesn't, she'll have to go home and get married, really, which she desperately does not want to do. She's forced to come home because her experiment fails. And at a Foreign Office ball, which Thaniel attends because he's now staff at the Foreign Office, she meets Thaniel, and later he agrees, for financial reasons, that they should get married. And she's delighted because if she has a husband, then she can inherit a lot of money from her aunt and a house in Kensington with a basement which she can convert into a laboratory. So this is a mutually beneficial agreement. And they get married halfway through the novel.
And so these 3 central characters, Maury and Grace and Thaniel, come into each other's orbit. And one of the things that I found intriguing about your novel was the way that in the last section of the book, our sense of who these characters are and who we're sympathetic to shifts a number of times. And it's particularly that our ideas about Maury and Grace are unsettled. Is that what you wanted to do as a writer? Did you want us to rethink who we thought your characters were?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a tendency in Victorian fiction for anybody in any kind of inappropriate relationship to die at the end. And this is really typified in things like George Eliot. You know, somebody goes on a boat trip with a man she shouldn't, they don't do anything, but, you know, this is scandalous and therefore she must die in a flood at the end. And Thomas Hardy is typical as well. You know, do anything in Thomas Hardy, you'll be run over by a cart. I didn't want that to happen to Thaniel Amory. So I wanted to have Grace be sympathetic at the start, but she becomes increasingly difficult to sympathise with as the story goes on, and that's definitely deliberate because the sympathy has to sit with Maury.
And is that why then we have Gilbert and Sullivan coming into the story? Because that's like a different model of late Victorian resolution. I mean, why is Gilbert and Sullivan there?
They're there because historically they were actually there. I brought them into the plot really because at the time that Thaniel is exploring the show village, they were there doing research for the Mikado.
And what about thematically? I mean, did it work as a well, it was almost like a surreal romance motif.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I include them in the story, really, is that Thaniel is a pianist, he's a musician, but he's never been able to do this. And by a series of careful but very simple manoeuvres, Maury manages to get him to meet Arthur Sullivan, who's trying to compose the music for the Mikado in the months before the performance in the middle of the novel. And so really, this is kind of one of Maury's very quiet romantic gifts. He's arranging a future that is much better for Thaniel than anything Thaniel could have found on his own.
Now, Natasha Pulley, this feels like an ambitious debut novel. Will you re-enter this version of London in your fiction?
I don't know if I'll re-enter this version of London. Thaniel and Maury will return. The next part of their story, though, is set in Japan.
And you've travelled to Japan as part of a fellowship, I think.
Yes, it was a scholarship funded by the Daiwa Anglo-Japanese Foundation. I was there for 19 months. I studied Japanese for a year. I did a month's homestay with two Japanese families. And then I worked at a university in Tokyo for 6 months after that. One of the things that it did for me was make me understand very clearly what it is to be a foreigner in one of the few still relatively homogenous countries.
And so you will follow these characters to Japan?
Yes, yeah. The new story, I have about half of it at the moment, but it begins in Kagoshima, which is one of the arch-conservative places in Japan in the late 1880s, and then it moves to Tokyo, and then the very northern island, which is Hokkaido. And in that one, it's going to be Thaniel's turn to be the foreigner, and he's going to see Maury in a very different light, because Maury will be at home and not foreign anymore. So I think part of the idea is to take away some of the exoticism that surrounds Japan in the first novel and bring it right back to very simple things and make it clear that this is home for Maury and Thaniel is the intruder this time.
And Nathaniel Pulley's, or Natasha Pulley's, novel is called The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, and it's published by Bloomsbury Circus. And she was speaking to Kate Evans. And, of course, Kate is with you for Books Plus here on RN on Sunday afternoons at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But you can catch her program, you can catch our program, you can catch the whole of the Radio National lineup. If you podcast, just pop along to the website, you can podcast away. And, of course, you do need that ABC Radio app on your phone, and you will not know yourself.